This is the first time that I've actually put all of this information together in one session. The grief part is usually part of the session I did yesterday, and then because I wanted to talk about trauma and mental health among MKs, I decided to group them all together. So you're the inaugural run of this particular set of topics. A reminder that I used yesterday as well, because we're going to go a little bit dark today and talk about some of the potential pitfalls of growing up MK. I wanted to begin by reminding you that 99%-something of MKs would not give it up for anything. Even those whose stories I'm going to be telling today would still say, I love being an MK. I'm so glad that I got to grow up MK. So the plan today is to talk about what some of the pitfalls or what some of the potential for trauma is, for two reasons: in order to be able to mitigate it, to recognize, first of all, the risk and address it and name it, and then to mitigate some of the, to avoid it if possible, or mitigate the response to it as needed. As always, this information is taken from articles that I have written. My website is michellephoenix.com, Michelle with one L, and then here's just a sampling of some of the topics that are on that website. From the sublime to the ridiculous, we try to hit everything that's pertinent to MKs. I try to hit everything that's pertinent to MKs. And for those who rather consume their information in an audio format, the Pondering Purple podcast is where a majority of those articles are now available. It's just me reading the articles, no interviews, nothing like that, but that could be a useful thing too. So since we're going to talk about some hard things today, I thought we'd open with a video of MKs talking about bright things. A few years ago, I asked adult MKs if they would send me the reasons they love being an MK, and then I asked parents of MKs around the world to have their little kids recite the answers that the adult MKs had given, and it yielded this.
I'm an MK.
I'm an MK.
I'm an MK.
I'm K.
When I watch The Amazing Race, I can say, been there, done that.
My backyard was the Amazon forest.
I love the sound of rain on a tin roof.
Beauty's on fries. Really try it. It's really good.
I've driven in 8 countries in one day.
I went to grade school in Indonesia, middle school in Africa, and high school in Europe.
I know what a meal cooked over smoldering manure tastes like.
I got to ride in the rain in Africa.
Laws are really just a suggestion.
I had coconuts fall on my head.
I love airports.
A pink DNA keeps the doctor away.
I've literally watched the sunrise over the Serengeti.
I've eaten snake, dog, and larvae.
I stink at idioms.
A grand banana.
And a nose.
A princess dress is better than a bird in your hand.
We carpool to school in a canoe.
Airports are my happy place.
They made me love and respect every country.
I get great stories to tell my kids.
Newness doesn't scare me.
I have more compassion for foreigners who come here.
I have bread and berries all over the world.
It has broadened my perspective.
My world is broader, my roots go deeper.
I've learned that difference is something to be celebrated.
And I wouldn't give it up for a moment.
I wouldn't give up for a moment.
I wouldn't give it up for a moment.
Not for a moment.
Would you?
Would you?
Would you?
Would you?
Nope. Heck no.
No.
Working with MKs. those faces, and to see some of them grow up is just fantastic, to see how they move through all those phases. So as a repeat from yesterday, just to remind us of why we're doing what we're doing today, we cannot protect and equip RMKs until we understand their lives from their perspective, not from adult perspectives, not from monocultural perspectives, not from mature faith perspectives, but from the perspective of a child growing up in a confusing world who is innerly confused as well because they are such a puzzle of cultures and influences. So we're going to be looking at three things today: grief, trauma, and mental health in the MK. And we're going to start with grief. And the point is to be preventative and proactive. Once we recognize what it is that we're looking at, what do we do with that? So there will be several times when I open it up for you to ask questions or to contribute your answers to what we're discussing. So be thinking in those terms as we're going through this. There is so much that MKs love about growing up between worlds, and there is so much that they also find difficult. And they are capable in a unique way of holding both at the same time. It's a tension that they live in. And this MK called Danica, who grew up in a place that looks very much like this, had this to say about that tension she lives in. She said this: how to reconcile the good bits, the dancing on moonlit beaches, the camaraderie of roasting jungle birds over an open fire, the heartbreaking beauty of untouched nature, how to reconcile all of that with the clouds of mosquitoes hovering so thick over your head that you can't see the sky, with boat trips where you fear for your life, with the soul-shattering pain of leaving an entire universe behind. And then she says this: so I linger in the space between, the space of mourning and rejoicing, the space of bitterness and love, and in the lingering, I'm beginning to glimpse healing. I think those words express it so well and so poetically, which is my love language. I mentioned yesterday that the average, and there will be about 5 minutes of overlap if you were here yesterday, just to kind of introduce the topic of grief and then to go a little bit more deeply into it, that the average TCK, so those are cross-cultural kids who are MKs and diplomats' kids and business kids and military kids, that's the broader third culture kid group, they have 8 major moves on average by the age of 18. And I would love for you to think, I know that all of you have had major moves at some point in your lives, to think in terms of what the losses were. Think of one move and what the losses were associated with that one move. And I'm not just talking the big moving houses, moving buildings where we work. I'm talking about all those smaller, more ingrained things that we lose, the tastes, the sounds, the sights, the traditions, the language, all of those smaller things. And try to make kind of in your own minds an inventory of how many of them you would come up with, thinking of just one move. I'm going to give you a minute to ponder that. Maybe go through the 5 senses to help you figure those out. You're starting to get a sense of how long that list could be if we stopped and really zeroed in on each aspect of the life that is left behind. For some MKs, it's the sound of car horns, those who come from places like India and Nepal, who for them, that's a comfort sound. For me, I went to Nepal. I am not built for Nepal. I discovered really fast. But for them, it's a comforting sound, and to have traffic that is absolutely chaotic. And I am convinced that in Nepal, the taxi drivers fly like bats do. You know, bats just hear the sounds of horns, so they know by the horns how close the vehicles on either side of them are. It's the languages. It's the, when I ask MKs like the group that I've met with here, a lot of times the first thing they'll mention is the foods, the comfort foods that just feel like home to them. And if there's anything you can do for your MKs to allow them to internalize those foods as often as possible, it really is a therapeutic thing for them to taste things that feel like home. So for a lot of MKs, this is the kind of things that they lose with every major move. I'll list some of these for you. The loss of relatives when they leave what would be called their home culture, which I call their passport culture. For me, I remember when my grandparents died, grieving not that my grandparents had died, but that I had never known my grandparents. I didn't feel like I knew them. That's a form of loss. Social networks, their youth group, their Sunday school group, their sports teams, whatever it was that gave them a context in which they felt like home. Their favorite things, which might be ridiculous. Can any of you give me an example of something that your kids thought was so important, and not to you, but to them, that they wanted to take it with them? First mind is somebody who had a beautiful rock that they wanted to take the rock with them. Can you think of any other small sacred objects, I call them? Yes? Yep, a tacky plastic figurine that he got from his best friend. That's where the value is. Yeah. Were you going to say something?
Books.
Books, yes. Yeah. Anything else? Any other examples of the sacred objects?
This is more like an experience that I don't think they really
okay.
It was, you know, like boys' road, boy
bike. Yes.
When they got to the new place, there was no boy bike, there were girls, but anybody wrote anything.
Yes.
And I remember them looking around.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. When I speak with families who are about to move and have little kids, I encourage them to find the size of box that you can afford to move and to give each child the same size box and tell them whatever you want to put in that, we'll move it. And it will be these silly little things and the figurines and a little bottle of sand from the beach where they used to live. And to them, that's sacred. And as adults, it might not be to us, but allowing them to choose the pieces of home that they carry. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And that is actually part of what we're going to look at. Do I let myself get attached to anything, including a bicycle? Because life has shown me that I might lose it, right? So, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Foods, I've mentioned languages. When I get off the plane in France and I hear the French language and those staccato sounds and the kind of in-your-face coming at you kind of French, not the romantic, mellow French that the Americans like. This is the real French. There's something about it that just fills me. Security. They knew what to expect in the place they lived, and now they have to figure out how to live in this new place. So that loss of security, of predictability for some of them. Status in the old place, people knew who they were. Oh, you're so-and-so's grandchild. Oh, you're, you know, the goalie on the soccer team. So that kind of context that gives them meaning. Lifestyle for some kids who leave a comfortable place to move to a more rudimentary kind of lifestyle. And then all of those combined together form this big, hard-to-define sense of loss. And when I speak with adult MKs, and we've tried to find a word that would communicate the intensity and the bigness of their loss, this is the word that they come up with. They feel like they have lost a universe with all the big recognizable things in it and with all those myriad smaller things that have meant everything to them. There's this word that I will not attempt to pronounce, but I love, it's a Welsh word, a homesickness for a home to which you cannot return, a home which maybe never was, the nostalgia, the yearning, the grief for lost places of your past. It has no direct translation in English, but I think if MKs could put something on a T-shirt, this might be it, because it reveals that grief that they carry within them. I do reentry retreats in Canada, and I'm going to take a little pause here to say if your kids are coming back from the field, reentering and expected to stay here for a while, do not hesitate to send them to a reentry retreat. There are great ones on the American side as well. It is the only time that I tell parents, do this even if your kids say they're going to hate you for it, because within 24 hours of being there with other MKs at the same phase of life, they will be worshiping the ground you walk on for forcing them to go to this marvelous experience. So at one of these retreats, this is Muki. He was an MK from Brazil, and he's this big hockey-playing, tough, funny Canadian boy. And we do a whole day on grief at these retreats, the whole day, and it ends with a symbolic moment by the water, by a river every night, where they release something and claim something. But we were just starting on grief, and I sent them out to do what I just suggested you do in your minds, which is for an hour for them, make an inventory of the places, the people, the things you have lost, and really be thorough about it. And he came waltzing back into the room where he's wearing his Canadian hat, which never left his head. And I said, so Mookie, what have you been processing? What did you write down in your journal? And he draped himself over my shoulder and began to sob because he had just understood the enormity of what he had left behind. And it's all the upheaval of transition and preparing for college, and all of that had masked it in his mind, but by doing that inventory, he had finally figured out what he had left. And this is what he wrote in his journal, which I read to you with his permission. He said, I lost my home, my security, my church, my friends, my job, my relationships. It continues to haunt me that I will never see the places that I roamed in the same light again, nor will I breathe the air as someone who is planted there. I lost myself in the convoluted mission of leaving. There is no way to express how lost I feel, and I don't think anything can change that. No amount of crying or talking will heal my soul. I feel like grief has become my reluctant love language. And he is not alone. Some studies that have been done on MKs show that the number of goodbyes they've said and losses they've experienced actually amounts to the same kind of grief as losing a primary caregiver, a parent. So they carry it with that intensity in their hearts. And I can tell you that after spending that day on grief and continuing the conversation throughout the week, Mookie left a different person at the end of that week, because not only had we addressed things, but we had validated that it's not weakness, it's not lack of faith for you to be grieving in this way. So a lot of times at these same retreats, I give the MKs an outline of a mask that is not meant to hide, but to reveal what grief they carry within them. If they were to walk into a room with this mask on, people would be able to understand what they're carrying. So I'm going to give you a sampling of them. Here's one. This is a young lady who had to evacuate in the middle of the night when war broke out in her North African country. So you can see the symbolism there. A much younger child who in the middle there says, I do not like to say goodbye, I like to say hi. And there's a sad little lion-y, tiger-y thing at the bottom that's expressing that. A more intense artist painted this one. And the way he explained it to me is that he keeps trying to get away from the grief, but he's standing in it. And so he stands on one foot and then he stands on the other foot, and it's just always there. Some MKs are better with words. So this is a list of losses that she was probably 18 or 19 when she wrote this one. And then a Korean MK, you can see the symbolism in that mask. Those backward sevens apparently are kind of like a humorless chuckle, like a ha ha ha, but not really funny. So that's what she's got in hers. And then this beautiful artist who actually is taking off the mask and showing what's underneath the mask. And you can tell what kind of background she comes from. I yesterday showed you a video by Caleb. It's a spoken word video. And for those of you who are not here yesterday, I'm just going to show you the first half again. It's about a minute long. Caleb was at one of those retreats. And to give you the context, I had just talked about a little boy in Nepal in third grade who had talked with me and with the class about good ways to say hello and good ways to say goodbye. And his name was Ryan. Caleb changes his name to John. But he said, in talking about how to say hello in a meaningful way, he said, I put my hand out and I shake their hand when I meet them, and I say, hi, my name is Ryan, and I'm going to be gone soon. So he enters into relationships by making it clear up front that he is fully aware that this might not last. So just for you to hear the voice of an MK speaking about grief, this first half of this spoken word, and I don't think we have time for the second half today, but if you email me, my contact will be up there. I will send you the full YouTube clip.
So hi. And there's no my name is John, and I'm going to be gone soon. I've played the tune of goodbye so many times my introductions begin with an end. I've had friends hold on so tight they just end up bruising my heart, so I'll make sure goodbye takes part in my hello. I'll make sure I let them know my name and my future before I rupture my heart over another friend I cannot keep. So my seeping heart refuses to let people in, because an exit wound is too much to bear, and if someone was to say I don't care, they'd be wrong. My heart longs for friendships and love, but it's continually undone by the plane ride that divides me from commitment. So my name is John, and I'm gonna be gone soon, because my hi was shaped by the plane rides and hello was molded by the yellow pages I constantly left behind. I have friends I've never met because seeing meant being there, and there was never where I was. So my closest friends were phantoms that mirrored friendship without the requirement of presence.
And yet, to watch Caleb, the man who wrote this, young man who wrote this video, to watch him surrounded by other MKs and doing this retreat, you would never know that that was in there. Because again, they have the ability to hold the wonderful and the hard at the same time. And sometimes out of practicality and sometimes out of image preserving, they're going to present the good and the happy before they address the other part of what they're coping with. So we've talked about the losses and the goodbyes, they say. I would love to hear from you. What other things can happen in the course of growing up and in the course of being an MK that can kind of add to this accumulation of difficulty or of challenges that some of them carry? What are the other things that can happen in their life that would register as grief for them or as just something hard and overwhelming? Can you give me any ideas of what some of those other things might be? And some of them would happen in any life, MK or not, but they're not immune to them, obviously.
Loss of a pet or a family member.
Yes, loss of a pet. Yeah, there's so much I could say about that. But when I ask MKs about what they miss the most, a lot of times food and pets are going to be the two things that come up real fast.
I heard loss of a family member. I think for us, the issue was not being able to be there.
Yes.
When that family.
Yes. And that absence is something that plays out in many ways. Even not being able to participate in big family celebrations, the weddings, the whatever it might be. So the losses and the celebrations that they can't be present at. Yeah, what else is there? Yeah.
I think the loss of the schedule they want.
Yes, the predictability. Yeah. And for those, again, MKs are all different. I'm painting with a very broad brush today, but for some of them, that is their comfort zone, is knowing, looking at the calendar and knowing exactly what's going to happen and how, right? Yeah.
I think something that's coming to my mind is that, like, her son is really struggling with the fact that he wants to go back.
Yes.
To where he
yes. 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 Yeah. 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 And that can actually be a very therapeutic investment for families to make, is 2 or 3 years, not a year after, but 2 or 3 years after you've left a place, to find a way for the kids to go back and still love so much that's still there, but realize that now they have a foot on 2 continents, a foot on 2 planets. And that what they're remembering in their mind is no longer ongoing in the place where it happened. Yeah. So here are a few other things that you've been seeing. Unbelonging is something that some of them carry with them, the sense of not belonging anywhere. Trauma, that again, MKs are not immune to trauma. It happens here and it happens there. Abuse, neglect, evacuations. Those MKs who have had to move on the spur of the moment, under the shadow of darkness, are the ones that really feel those transitions more intensely, obviously. Illness or mental illness, poverty, expectations. We talked about them this morning with the MKs, the shoulds that they live under, many of which have never been spoken to them. But the MKs feel that there are superhuman expectations put on them. Because you're an MK, you should overachieve, always be happy, be up for any hard thing God calls your family into. You should be a biblical scholar at age 7. You should have led people to the Lord. You should never complain. And if somebody witnesses you acting badly, then that's a shame on you and your family and their work and God himself. So those shoulds are huge. And anything that you can do as parents to diffuse some of them, goodbyes, transitions, anxiety, all of those add up in this hard stuff that some MKs, not all of them, that some MKs carry. And it can end up feeling a little bit like this. So I want to make this clear. MKs don't just experience grief. They experience it and accumulate it. So the grief kind of builds on itself with them. And if you've ever been in a boarding school around graduation time, when it is a predictable outcome, we are going to graduate, we are going to say goodbye, but this gives them permission to let some of that grief go. And it looks like somebody has died at graduation time. Like there's major mourning going on because, yes, they are grieving, saying goodbye to their friends and to the boarding school or to the high school that they attended, whatever it might be. And all of that accumulated grief is finding its way to the surface because this event gives it permission to be shown. Now, I also need you to know that the grief is not always going to be visible, even to parents who are so connected with their children and you have a great relationship. Sometimes it's not going to be visible because one of our traits as MKs, and I am an MK born and raised in France, one of our traits is that we want to protect our parents from our stuff. So even though we might feel it keenly and we might even be able to say that is exactly what's hurting me, we might not tell mom and dad about it because they're so stressed out and they're doing God's work, we don't want to add our stuff to what they carry. So in this picture, for instance, this is one of the reboot groups from Calgary. We have three brothers in there who knew that their mother was going to die within 2 weeks. She died of breast cancer, and yet they were joyful and the smile was real, and what they carried invisibly was also real. Both of those are real. We had one young lady whose father, she revealed to us, was an alcoholic on the field, a blackout alcoholic, and yet her smile was real too. There were both those components in her life. And one other young lady whose face is blurred in the middle, and by the way, I have no problems with babies making noises in my session, so don't worry about me. The one with the face blurred, when reboot started, she got a note from one of her relatives saying that her parents in China had just been taken into custody and were under house arrest at this point. And yet, she was laughing and enjoying her time with her friends and occasionally breaking down because mom and dad were in custody. So don't expect that an MK's grief is going to be obvious all the time, because we're capable not only of protecting our parents by hiding it, but also of truly finding joy in other things at the same time. I mentioned this yesterday. I'll mention it again because it is kind of one of my mottos. Grief must be witnessed in order to be healed. Grief must be spoken and people must hear the words in order for healing to begin. And so many MKs think the opposite. Grief must be denied and silenced in order to be healed. So we're very good at stuffing grief. We're very good at denying that it's there and kind of shoving it down. Why do you think that MKs tend to shove down or hide or tamp down their grief? What do you think are some of the reasons that we're so good at doing that? Is that a hand? Yes.
Maybe pressure not only from the missionary parents, but also maybe from the people who support their family. Like,
yes. Yes.
They feel that pressure, like, oh, I have to, you know, put on a good face.
Yeah. Yep.
Obey my parents, doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
If I don't, then if they stop supporting us,
that's right. That's right. I wrote a whole article about that. It's called Holy Hypocrisy. So yes, it's a thing. What other reasons? What other things make us stuff our grief?
I think in my case, my daughter doesn't want to share her grief with me. My husband and I can feel stressed.
Yes. Yep. Yes, very possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, you would want to know what's going on with her,
yeah,
but she doesn't realize that.
Yeah.
She thinks she's protecting you, parenting you in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other reasons? Yeah. Yes. 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 Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You've covered a lot of the ones that I'm going to present to you right now. And I can't really read what's at the bottom. This is the barn where we keep our feelings. If a feeling comes to you, bring it out here and lock it up. That's the, because that's a healthy way to do life, isn't it? So here are some of the reasons that MKs tough grief. Number one, nobody knows. It's a hidden loss. If they are with adults, the adults, because of what we talked about yesterday, MKs are purple. They're all convoluted in their understanding of the world and themselves and God, and their parents have a much clearer understanding of all of those, so they feel like nobody's really going to get it from their purple perspective. No time to mourn, you just mentioned that. When parents are leaving the field, I encourage them to find a way, raise the funds if you need to, do a 10-day layover in Iceland, or get off the plane on this side of the continent and go hole up in a cabin somewhere where nobody knows that you're there, and give yourselves time to realize this is really happening. We really did say goodbye, because you all know the chaos of departure, right? There's no time to actually process anything. And again, if you're a child, even less ability. Fear of becoming a burden, that's exactly what you mentioned, fear of becoming a burden. Fear of losing our grip on grief, I mentioned that earlier. Fear that if we let a little bit out, it's going to be this torrent that we can't control anymore. Lack of permission If you go to my website and look under MK articles, the 6 permissions most MKs need goes into this a little bit more deeply. But we sometimes, they don't feel like we have given them permission to show grief. And as ridiculous as it is, sometimes they're going to have that expressly stated to them. It is okay and good to be sad about things. Pressure to be resilient to TCKs or MKs, which is one of the shoulds, I think. You're resilient. We tell them that all the time. In my experience, particularly with younger MKs, sometimes what we identify as resilience is lack of permission or lack of vocabulary to express the hard stuff. So we think they're being resilient. They just don't know how to tell us that they're not resilient, that they're hurting, and that they need help. Fear that there will be no comfort. Mom and Dad are so busy. The whole community is so busy. I'm just a small piece of it. Why would they stop what they're doing for me? And then no memorial or funeral. Every culture has some kind of ritualistic approach to death, and these kinds of goodbyes are deaths to these MKs, and yet we don't have it in our communities a lot of times. So I encourage families to figure out what your ritual is going to be so that every time there is a big goodbye or a big transition or a big upheaval, you can go back to that predictable ritual of saying goodbye. One family, they write notes to the people that are leaving. They make them into little paper boats and they float them down the stream. Another family release lanterns into the sky. So whatever it is that would be meaningful for those families to figure out what it is and to allow their children to have this memorial or this funeral. Now, you've all heard of the 5 stages of grief, and I put this up here just because they're usually presented in a linear fashion. You go from this to this to this to this to this. And this is actually Pam Davis, who is a professor of psychology, and she says it's a wheel that rolls forward and rolls back, and there's no, again, predictability, which is what we want, but the grief process itself is going to be unpredictable. And we need to let the MKs know that it's okay, because once they see the stages of grief, they're going to think that I should do this all in the right order and not realize that it's not a failure to be back at anger again after you thought you were so close to being through it. I'm actually going to take a small break because my computer is almost out of power and my plug is there. So what I'd like for you to contemplate is what else, what other aspects of the MK world can harm their faith. So the grief can harm their faith in some ways that we're going to explore a little bit more, the amount of goodbyes they have to say because God dictates that the family move or because God didn't intervene, that I'm speaking from their minds. What other things can you envision in the missionary life that could potentially be harmful to their faith? Think about that for a second. Music to my ears. Can you think of other aspects of the missionary life that they could, maybe not logically, but could attribute to God or to something damaging to faith? Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yes. Isn't that great? And I just need to say this because it goes for everything we're going to be talking about today. It is never too late to go back and have these conversations. Even if the kids are 50 years old today, it is never too late to go back and have those conversations. And I've seen them be healing things in a miraculous way, even decades after the actual circumstances are gone. Yeah. Anything else? Yes. 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 Yeah. 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 And that can so easily lead to cynicism, right? Yeah. Yes. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't do that because
yeah. That's right.
Why are we fighting? So
yes.
Yes.
Yep.
The
yeah. And we talked yesterday, you never heard us kids fight, right? Never. We talked yesterday about how furlough can also be a breeding ground for that kind of misstatement. We don't mean to say look good at all times, but we kind of convey that, yeah. Oh my goodness, yes. Yes, all eyes are on you. I had one MK describe it as being in a fishbowl on the back burner. There's an image in the mind, in a fishbowl on the back burner. What the fishbowl is doing on a burner, I don't understand entirely, but that's what it is. Yes. Were you going to say something? I thought I saw you. You were agreeing? Yes. That whole being guest in somebody else's home as the honored missionary is a big deal. It's a big deal. I'm going to show you a short video of some adult MKs talking about what the other factors were that affected how they viewed God, and all of these have worked through it that you're going to see. They're on a really good path today, but just so you can see how things that we assess as adults might be perceived differently as young people. So here they are.
I grew up with an Islamic flavor to my God, which I didn't realize till I sort of started thinking it through, but my God was very much one that you give a lot to and you kind of hope for things in return. So I think there was this sense of this very unstable, unsafe God who kind of wanted me to suffer to prove something to him.
I mean, it didn't matter where you were. They would stop, pull out their prayer mats, and they were praying, and I remember thinking, they're so much more committed than I feel like I am. And yet, we're here saying that they're lost. How do I know that they're the ones that have it wrong and not me?
In my own experience, a lot of my faith was just acted out without much knowledge.
So I kind of went through the shock of like, well, do I even know what I believe? And do I believe the right thing? And there's things that I thought I knew that do I know now?
Just the hardship of moving and not having like stable relationships and like blaming that on their parents and on God and on God's call to their parents.
In high school, I didn't know how to understand or cope with the losses. So my coping mechanism was to be angry. I used to be so angry, like throwing stuff around and just this anger, this deep anger toward God, toward my parents, toward my whole life. Was really deep.
There's a lot of pressure put on children, put on me and my brother, to play our part. Not just in this, not just in our missionary community, not even overseas. Even coming back to the States, a lot of pressure to play and act. You know, visiting churches, we have to play the good Christian missionary sons.
God had them like preparing for ministry for 10 years. My dad left his job. He went to Bible college. We raised support forever. It was like pulling teeth. And then we get there and we're there 4 years less than it took to get there. It was horrible for my parents in Russia, and it was horrible for my brothers.
I have some friends that I'm not as much in touch with anymore, but who I know have struggled with their faith and have experimented with other religions and with other ways to find peace and to find what's missing. And I know that some of them are very lost.
So that gives some insight into the minds of these MKs. Sunny, the Korean young lady that you saw, apparently is the vice principal at a school right across the street here. Now, I had lunch with her the other day for the first time. So I forget what the name of the church is. Do you remember, Mom? This is my mom, Mom Sally. She was a missionary for 37 years overseas in France. But anyway, I just love that I just saw her, and now here she is on the screen. And the healing of that young lady who was so angry. She's the one who said, I just got angry and started throwing things. And I told her over lunch the other day, the first glimpse I got of her 2 days ago, I could tell that there was a serenity there. There was just this change in her. So this is a look at how different aspects of the missionary life can have an impact on how they view God. And what I've seen in some MKs, and the MKs that do show anger, is that it's anger at God a lot of times. But they don't feel like they're allowed to say that, so they might not identify it as such. And there are several, oh, I love this quote right here. So a lot of times when we see anger in MKs, we need to wonder if the root of it is actually grief. And anger is a more sanitized way of showing the emotion of grief for some of them. So those MKs who show or who feel anger towards God will have one of these four responses usually. Do you want me to go back so you can take that picture? I saw you back there. I mean, it used to be people took notes, right? Now we just take pictures of screens. So the first response when they realize, oh, I am angry at God, this is not good, I am an MK, will be to recoil in shame. I am bringing shame to myself, to my parents, to their ministry, to God himself. This feeling of shame. Another approach to it will be to resurface, to cover it with good. So this MK realizes I'm really angry at God and how he didn't come through or how he forced these things on my family, but I'm going to go on every mission trip I can go on. I'm going to be the girl who volunteers for all the duties. I'm going to try and pacify myself by doing good things when I know that there's anger underneath there. The third will reject God. God is the villain. I have known some MKs, this by no means is the majority of them, but those who reject God are the reason that my ministry is focused on MKs and not the broader group of TCKs, because that eternal peace is so important to me. And for anybody to walk away from the faith because they were raised in the faith, in the sense of mission work, is just heartbreaking to me. So that's one of the reasons that I do what I do. And finally, reframing their faith. I was at John Brown University a couple years ago, and I was doing something like this with their adult MKs, their students there. And we had gone through the grief, and they had given examples of what has been hard in their life. And when I asked them, what is your theology of grief? Where is Jesus in the grief that you're experiencing? It was crickets. None of them had an answer to that. Because we don't teach a theology of grief very well. Or very often. So this is what I would love to discuss with you at some point. Because in the ways that we respond to the hard things that MKs deal with, in some of the words we say, we're actually making God the inflictor of our pain. I want you to imagine the words that we say as mature in our faith adults and how young kids will hear those words and how that will paint a picture of who God is in their minds that is hard to undo. There are in the Bible so many sources of the pain in our world. These are just five of them. Flawed humanity, people who sin, people who do things wrong. Collateral damage, those who suffer because of the sin of other people who are doing things wrong. Direct attacks of the enemy cause a lot of the pain that we experience. Cataclysmic events, the tsunamis, the shifting tectonic plates that cause them, and the decay of mortal bodies that lead to illness and eventually death. These are all sources of pain, and yet in Christian circles, we tend to always make God not only the guy who is okay with our pain, but sometimes the person, the God, the deity who inflicts our pain. I would love for you to tell me what some of those easy statements are that we make to the suffering that to a child might be misunderstood as making God the perpetrator. Can you think of, and I did this with the teenagers this morning, and let me tell you, they had some doozies. So what are some of the easy things we say that are misleading? God is sovereign. Which, again, he is. All things work out for good. They do. But listen to that through the grid of the currently suffering child. Yeah. 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 Any pain has to come. It's sifting through his fingers. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I don't want to be triggering, but we were having this conversation at a reboot a couple years ago, and people were throwing out these idioms and these partial verses and concepts, and one girl said, so God is okay that my dad was taken captive and I haven't seen him again in 8 years? God's okay with that? That sifted through his hands and he's fine with me being an orphan? I mean, strong words, but we're so casual in articulating things that aren't fully fleshed out to kids who don't have the depth of faith that adults do. And honestly, even sometimes it's confusing to me, let's be honest. I don't get it either. So we need to be so careful about the words we use around MKs who are suffering. Before a transition, God called us back to the States, or God called us to Venezuela or wherever it might be. The God called us indicates, can seem to indicate, that he doesn't care about you, because I know you love it here, but we're moving. So being really careful in how we represent God and God's call to these young people who don't have the wherewithal to really figure it out. I love to go back to the story of Elijah, who went off into the mountains, was in this cave in the mountains. The Bible says that the storm was so strong that rocks were rising up and clashing and breaking. So huge storm. And in the Christian world, I think we would be likely to say, well, that was God trying to teach Elijah a lesson. Look at what he was doing to those rocks. And the one verse in the middle of the story says, and God was not in the storm. And we need to give our children the ability to believe that God is not in every hard thing that happens to us, and that it is a still small voice that we hear sometimes in the middle of that cataclysmic storm. So for some MKs, they end up with this view of God, the tyrannical, heartless, dictating God. And we need to be the voices that contradict and soften the image that they might have of him. I saw this very short video, it's 7 seconds long, on Facebook a few years back, and immediately in 7 seconds was in tears. That's better than a Hallmark commercial. And I could not figure out why. I'm going to show it to you twice. It's kind of MKE in that the coach tells this little boy that he needs to keep his eye on the ball, and he takes it very literally. We stink at idioms, so this little boy took it very literally. Watch the coach in this first version, and then I'll show you the second version. That coach going like this is what MKs expect of God. Many of them, not all of them, many of them. When I fail, when I'm not strong enough, when I'm not resilient enough, when I want to complain, when I'm angry, when I am frustrated, God goes, you're an MK, come on, we've talked about this. Now let's watch this one more time. And then this. That's the God we need to introduce our MKs to. Yes, the expectations are there. They're couched in grace and mercy and understanding of the fallen human state. We need to introduce them to a God who does have standards and who will love them regardless of what they do. So my question to you is this. What can adults of influence do to help MKs who are struggling with grief and faith? What are some things? This is a huge question. I'll put this up here, too, because it's kind of the basis of why I'm asking this question. What can we as adults of influence, whatever it may be, we might be the grandpa and grandma types in the missionary community. I'm the single aunt type in the missionary community. What can we do to help MKs who are struggling with grief and faith? Give me some suggestions. Yes. Help them to get it out. How can we do that?
Listen without answers.
Yeah. Listen without answers. Listen with love and without answers. Yes.
Ask questions.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And for those who are trying to keep mom and dad safe from their stuff, to have a question asked makes them know, oh, so I can tell you about it. I don't need to protect you from me. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, share your own grief. If they can see the grown-up adult missionary people grieving, then it's going to be okay for them too. Any other suggestions? I'll give you four of mine. And you've said it all. Foster an open and honest communication within your family. It needs to start early. It needs to become the family culture. Acknowledge the validity of their pain. Of course you're sad. Of course you're hurting. Show them how to grieve honestly and healthily. That's demonstrating it for them. And then finally, it's a big one, model relationship with God more than employment by God. So often it's easy to see missionary work as our job and not a relationship. And that will be a source of all kinds of misunderstandings. I recommend this book by Sky Jatani. who happens to be a personal friend, who has written a series of fantastic books on what if the Bible was serious, about prayer, about the Sermon on the Mount. But this one in particular looks at the ways that we've misinterpreted what faith is in a lot of ways and what it actually was meant to be. He came to be with us. No obligations, nothing we need to earn, no image we need to maintain. So this is a really good book. I would say ages 14, 15, if you read it with them up, or you can read it and just condense it down for the younger kids if you're dealing with that. A reminder of the strengths of MKs because, whew, and now we're about to go deeper, so brace yourselves. We're not quite done yet. And that they love being MKs, this is fantastic. The second topic we're covering is trauma. This is something that I feel so strongly about because my life has been a life of trauma. I am one acquainted with trauma. And we haven't talked about it in missionary circles for so long, and there is finally some great research being done. I am the survivor of multiple forms of abuse when I was a child. I am the survivor of, and she's fine with me mentioning this, an unhealthy, dysfunctional family. I am the survivor of horrible transitions in which I wasn't surrounded in the way I needed to be, and then a 3-time cancer survivor as well. So there's lots of trauma that has accumulated over my lifetime, and I didn't have somebody speaking these truths that I'm going to try to impart to you to speak into the lives of your MKs. I do what I do today because I want to be the person I needed when I was 16, 17, and 18 years old. So let's talk about trauma. At that reentry retreat last summer, I noticed that the signs of trauma were much more prevalent than they have ever been before. The pandemic, of course, has pushed things to the surface that might have been more easily tamped down before. We bring in law enforcement every year to teach these kids what law and order is on this continent versus Romania, where, you know, rules are merely a suggestion. And these two police officers walked in their full gear, and one of our MKs made a beeline for the door, and I found her outside shaking and trying to get a breath because she had, in her former country, reported abuse, and two police officers from that country had locked her in a small room with them for 3 hours interrogating her. And to see that police officer walk into a Canadian setting had set her off. Here's Raya. We were just telling our stories of where you're from, and she pulled out her phone, modern technology, and on Google Maps found the village in Africa where she used to live and zoomed in for us. That's her zooming in right there. And she's very casually talking about this village and going, well, this is where we built a church, and it was razed when the rebels came through, and this is the field where our pastor and 3 of our elders were shot dead, and this is the footprint of where our house used to be, and it's been destroyed. It was a part of Africa where they had to be helicoptered in, so very remote, and she knows that the place she knew is gone, just wiped off the face of the earth. And that is trauma. And she's telling it as just an episode of her life story. And a third MK at that same retreat, we were all crowded into a Wendy's to get our dinner, and the chaos and the noise and the activity around him, this, again, tough young man, he was our oldest, 22, 23, he had to run out of the restaurant in a full-blown panic attack because it reminded him of the air raid shelters that he had had to hide in previously. So they are carrying trauma kind of embedded, tattooed onto our souls, and we need to be better at recognizing it for what it is. We like to think that time heals all wounds. I'm here to tell you that it doesn't. What it does is it kind of papers them over sometimes, and then they acidify and intensify under the surface until they find a way out. And if we give them that long to find a way out, they're not going to be pretty by the time they manifest in a way that's visible to others. MKs are not immune from trauma. Trauma is unavoidable, living in a broken world with broken bodies. Even in ministry contexts where we wish we would be spared, because we're doing God's work, right? I hear this from MKs all the time. We are here. We sacrificed everything to follow God, and this happened to our family. And this is the good news, though. But with greater understanding, with early detection, with compassionate support, with therapeutic intervention, trauma does not need to be a chronic destructive force. If we can recognize it and address it early, these MKs stand a chance of being healthier than my generation was. So what is trauma? The word gets thrown around a lot. I'm traumatized that they ran out of French fries when I was checking out of the restaurant. Trauma is so much more than that. And so I'm going to show you a professional video, just a minute and a half of it, that defines what trauma is. And I think you might be surprised by the clinical understanding of what trauma is. And then we'll talk about how it relates to MKs. They will mention Anne's. They refer to Anne's as a character. It is this little character in the video, and I want you to know it stands for autonomic nervous system when they talk about Anne's. So here's the video.
Understanding how trauma impacts us is critically important. There is a whole spectrum of experiences that can be traumatizing and adversely impact Anne's, like accidents, assaults, and natural disasters, which are often called shock traumas.
Think of the MKs as
there is also
this.
Developmental or relational trauma when we experience chronic adversity, abuse, neglect, and lack of safety while growing up. Many other experiences can be traumatizing, including chronic stress, medical procedures, and adverse community environments like poverty, discrimination, and violence. Additionally, new research in epigenetics shows us that trauma can get passed down genetically at least 3 generations. In the past, we've thought about trauma as events that happened to us. We now know that trauma is an experience, not an event. It's what happens inside of us as a result of what happens to us. It's our response to the event rather than the event itself.
Isn't that clarifying in a lot of ways? We tend to think of an event being the trauma. It is the response to that event. It is a trauma response that makes it trauma. And the importance of understanding that, the quote is, trauma is an experience, not an event. The importance of understanding that is that different people are going to interpret and respond to events in different ways. Within the same family, mom and dad might go through the same experience and not have a trauma response to it, and the children might have a trauma response to it. Or within the same family, one child might have a trauma response to it, and another child might not. So we need to understand that the trauma response is going to be reflective of a maturity level, perhaps, a degree of faith, perhaps, personality, self-esteem issues, fears that were pre-existing the event. All of these are going to determine whether an event is perceived as trauma to an MK or not. And we need to stop assessing how we respond to an event and assuming that because we responded that way, everybody else will too in the family. We're all going to have individual responses to trauma. Andy Kolber is a Christian counselor, and I'm going to mention her book a little bit later, but she defines it like this: anything that overwhelms the nervous system and our ability to cope. So think in terms of the children you know, the MKs you know, and itemize in your minds what are some of the life events they've been through that might have overwhelmed their nervous system and their ability to cope. And those are the things that might need talking through and addressing and maybe finding healing for them. Because even though it might have been okay for you to live through it and you found the silver linings and you moved on, for MKs it might have been perceived as trauma. So what does trauma do, actually? It engages the brain in different ways. It is a brain injury in certain ways. It engages the amygdala. That's the part of the brain that's responsible for fight or flight. When something happens, we go, fight or flight. Do I stay? Do I run? And with people who have been through repeated trauma, they get stuck in fight or flight mode. They are constantly, I have just gone through a 5-year period of anxiety. Never had anxiety in my life before. I think it was medically related for me. But all of a sudden, I found myself constantly scanning for the next bad thing that was going to happen. A loud sound would send me into panic mode. So the amygdala is stuck in this mode of scanning for danger and bracing for impact. Imagine what that feels like to a young spirit. The hippocampus, this is one of our memory storing facilities in the brain. Not only does it prevent us from storing short-term memories, we can't remember what we did 5 minutes ago, or the recipe we read, that last ingredient, gone from the brain. It also keeps us connected to the most traumatic memories that we have from the distant past. So when the amygdala is engaged in this way, in a traumatic way, we cannot stop remembering the horror horrors that we've experienced, which again, as an adult would be horrible. As a 10-year-old is worse. The only experience I have that would mimic this is after watching my dad pass away several years ago, and every time I went to bed and closed my eyes, I saw his face, his dead face, and it was stuck in that amygdala part of my brain, and I couldn't get rid of it. I was so relieved the day he was cremated because I thought that face is no longer there now. But that is what some of these MKs will live with as well. And then the third part is the prefrontal cortex. When it's healthy, this helps us to regulate emotions. It's the part of the brain that would say to the amygdala, this context is safe, you're overreacting, calm down, you're fine. But when it's altered by trauma, it'll have difficulty controlling feelings like fear and distrust. So all of a sudden, the rational piece of our brain is offline as well. Trauma actually injures the brain. We get stuck in fight or flight. We get incapable of suppressing horrific memories. And the part of the brain that's supposed to bring logic is incapable of doing so. So a lot of research has been done recently about ACEs. Have any of you heard about adverse childhood experiences? Yeah, really interesting. And just recently, large research was done on 1,100 MKs regarding ACEs in their lives. So let me give you a brief introduction to ACEs. Again, we're going to talk about ANS, the autonomic nervous system, and here.
20 years ago, Kaiser and the CDC launched a groundbreaking study of over 17,000 patients that showed a direct link between adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and long-term health and wellness. In the study, 2/3 of participants reported at least one ACE. Over 20% reported 3 or more. When participants reported 4 or more ACEs, this corresponded to an increased chance for heart disease, cancer, drug abuse, and more. With 6 or more ACEs, life expectancy decreases by almost 20 years. We are learning that many physical and emotional symptoms may emerge from a chronically dysregulated ANS. When ANS get stuck in survival states, our biology shifts its focus from the tasks that keep us healthy, happy, and thriving to surviving the immediate perceived threat. Many conditions and symptoms that are chronic and difficult to diagnose and treat can be attributed to a dysfunctional ANS.
Okay, can you see how that might relate to some of the MKs we know? So as a review, we're talking about these three major categories of toxic stresses: abuse, neglect, and household challenges. And remember that this was not specifically for MKs. This was the CDC that was actually looking at underprivileged families, not at international ministry families. And then the potential outcomes or the negative outcomes are these. I'll list some of them for you. They're more likely, if they have a score of 4 or above on the ACEs test, they're more likely to have physical illnesses, to become addicted, to fail at long-term relationships, to struggle with addiction, and to experience depression and anxiety. In the research that was done by, if you're not watching them, following them online, TCK Training is a fantastic group that does research into TCKs and MKs. They surveyed 1,100 MKs, and they found that 1 in 5 MKs scores 4 or above on that test. And 4 or above is what puts you into danger zone for negative future outcomes. But here's the good news. Toxic stresses do not need to be a destructive force, because when we know about them, we can mitigate them, we can avoid them, we can do whatever it is to help our MKs to grow up and be healthy. So the fact that 1 in 5 MKs are in the high-risk group for negative outcomes does also indicate that 4 out of 5 MKs are not. And let's take a moment to celebrate that. MKs actually score a little bit lower than military kids, and I'm sure you can imagine why. The higher-scoring MKs are those who have had more major transitions than others. So major transition is recognized as one of the exacerbating factors. Yes? TCK Training, I think it's tcktraining.org. And they've got lots of important materials out there. .com, thank you. So what would you add to the list of toxic stresses that are more specific to MKs? What other toxic stresses are there that we would add to the CDC's list that would help us to measure the ACEs and MKs? Can you think of any? I'm going to give you a bunch, but I'd love to hear yours too. Yeah.
Would every girl
this is where personality and maturity level and family culture do play into it, because it refers to trauma as well. Some kids will feel that as trauma and some will not. It can be. And it can be prevented or at least mitigated by advanced understanding of which kids are going to struggle most with it. It could, depending on who the child is. Yeah. Let me give you some of the extra toxic stresses that I would certainly add to the list. I'm going back. The incessant losses, of course, would be a toxic stress. Not fully belonging anywhere, feeling isolated and like we don't have a place that is shaped like us. The shoulds, the unreasonable expectations that they have on them. Again, this group that I met with back in Georgia back in February were adult MKs, and my goodness, they could list dozens and dozens of shoulds. Being visible or invisible immigrants, being visible immigrants meaning that you stand out in the culture where you are. People are touching your hair and touching your skin. Or being the invisible immigrants where people don't realize that you're not from there and you keep making a fool of yourself because you don't get how to be in that place. Witnessing violence, famine, evacuations, obviously, transitions, obviously. And again, the more the transitions, the higher the score, but this can be addressed. Perceived abandonment or neglect by their parents, this would be the fishbowl on the back burner. Suppressed emotions, when they feel like they're not allowed to express what is eating at them, that can become a toxic stress. And then we need to not forget spiritual warfare, which many of them are exposed to. Sometimes they recognize it for what it is and sometimes they don't. But spiritual warfare can also be a toxic stress that MKs live with. So I think that if we added these toxic stresses to the grading mechanism of the ACEs test and adjusted it accordingly, I think we might actually score a little bit higher than what they found in the research with the CDC's metrics. And I have seen some of the negative future outcomes in many of the MKs that I work with. I say many because it's often those who are struggling who reach out to me, so it's not representative of the broader body, but I've seen the addiction, I've seen the completely unexplained medical issues, the doctors are stumped, they don't know what it is, relational challenges, something that I would describe as failure to thrive. They do okay, but they just do okay for much of their lives. There's just something that's preventing thriving there. And then depression. Depression is a big one, and it's often misunderstood. There's a big difference between sadness and depression. So I have another video to introduce you to depression, because I think it's important that we recognize what we're seeing and not overdiagnose or underdiagnose what it is that's being presented to us. So here is a lovely dog story.
I had a black dog. His name was Depression. Whenever the black dog made an appearance, I felt empty and life just seemed to slow down. He could surprise me with a visit for no reason or occasion. The black dog made me look and feel older than my years. When the rest of the world seemed to be enjoying life, I could only see it through the black dog. Activities that usually brought me pleasure suddenly ceased to. He liked to ruin my appetite. He chewed up my memory and my ability to concentrate. Doing anything or going anywhere with a black dog required superhuman strength. At social occasions, he'd sniff out what confidence I had and chase it away. My biggest fear was being found out. I worried that people would judge me. Because of the shame and stigma of the black dog, I was constantly worried that I'd be found out. So I invested vast amounts of energy into covering him up. Keeping up an emotional lie is exhausting. Black dog could make me think and say negative things. He could make me irritable and difficult to be around. He would take my love and bury my intimacy. He loved nothing more than to wake me up with highly repetitive and negative thinking. He also liked to remind me how exhausted I was going to be the next day. Having a black dog in your life isn't so much about feeling a bit down, sad, or blue. At its worst, it's about being devoid of feeling altogether. As I got older, the black dog got bigger, and he started hanging around all the time. I'd chase him off with whatever I thought might send him running. But more often than not, he'd come out on top. Going down became easier than getting up again. So I became rather good at self-medication, which never really helped. Eventually, I felt totally isolated from everything and everyone. The black dog had finally succeeded in hijacking my life. When you lose all joy in life, you can begin to question what the point of it is.
Is that helpful to understand the difference between transitory sadness and sadness related to an event and being stuck in depression? One of the MKs, when we were talking about depression, wrote this, and darn it, it is way too small for me to read it. Just a minute. And he drew that drawing as well. He says, "Darkness grows. It takes root like a tree in my soul. It grows roots and branches spreading through my body. My heart is wrapped in its branches, trapped. But unlike a tree, darkness is hidden. No one sees its towering branches reaching around my heart and into my brain. Its roots tunneling through my soul and down through my body. It can't escape, so it stays here, growing and entangling my insides. It can't be killed. It stays and it grows." Obviously, depression looks like sadness sometimes. What are other things that we might see in a young person that are actually signs of depression but don't look like sadness? What are some other ways that it might show up? Anger, yes, it's the safer emotion. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Isolation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, losing interest in things they used to want to do. Yeah. Yeah, we think that it's sadness, and it's actually all these other things. The first one says the emotional equivalent of watching paint dry, which I think is a great way to put it. Isolation, self-loathing, anxiety, guilt, hopelessness, and sadness. One of the MKs this morning said, "My grandma died 6 years ago, and I was sad for a year. Is that depression?" And I said, "Well, I'd have to talk with you about that to figure it out. But there is an obvious sadness that will follow sad events." And I think the difference is our progress will go like this regardless of what it is. But if somebody, you lose somebody dear to you, and over the year you're feeling sad, but the general line is going in the upward direction, that's more likely to be situational sadness than if the line is going in this direction and there's no hint that it might be improving. A lot of times that's the difference between depression and sadness. So I'm going to give you a little primer on anxiety a little bit later as well. But why do we miss trauma in MKs? Why has it been overlooked for so many years? Do you have any ideas before I give you mine? Yes. It never dawned on you. Yes. Yeah. 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 Yes. Yes. And things that don't get reported to parents, even. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing today. Yes. Yeah, did you have one? Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that, again, is what we were looking at before. How you process it is going to be different, possibly, than how the children process it. Yeah, let me give you a few ideas. MKs unable to recognize trauma for what it is. They might assume that it's normal, so they don't report it to mom and dad as trauma. Let me give you a couple examples. I mentioned this first one yesterday, doing a reentry debrief with a 15-year-old girl who on show and tell day left the room and came back in decked out in a hazmat suit, head to foot. And to her, it was kind of a fun thing that she could show her friends. We found out that her dad was a doctor in an Ebola-ridden country and that the only time she had seen him in the months preceding their reentry, he was still over there, but was when the whole family was decked out in a hazmat suit. And the only way she saw her friends was when they were all decked out in hazmat suits. And this young lady had just left the field and they had found contraband flights out of the country where they were because technically they weren't allowed back to the States and they had somehow escaped the laws and made their way back to the States, which in itself would be trauma, right? Knowing that you're breaking the law and kind of trying to escape undercover. And then there's Ryan. He's one of these three boys who lived in Afghanistan when a bomb went out outside the compound where he was watching his three-year-old baby sister in the courtyard. And what he remembered, and again, he told this story so casually, what he remembered was the wall falling inward. His sister was on the monkey bars, all the windows blowing out. And he, I think, was 11 at the time. All the windows blowing out. And then he was crawling on his hands and knees over the broken glass trying to get to where he had last seen his sister, who was in his care. Mom and Dad had said, take care of your sister. And he didn't realize that that was trauma because bombs went off all the time in Afghanistan. So it wasn't until he told us his story that the other MKs looked at him like, therapy much? Because he was still, when he arrived, I wish I had that picture, when he arrived at this reentry retreat, he was decked out in this long duster, leather duster jacket and these reflective glasses and this look on his face that said, don't talk to me, don't even look at me. I'm not here. And by the end of the week, he was the boy in the middle who's smiling this way. So he was carrying that guilt of the trauma that had been imposed on him by the location in which he was living, no fault of his own. So this is why sometimes it doesn't get reported. Because MKs often live in unusual contexts that don't fit squarely into any of their multiple cultures, they may not develop a baseline understanding of what is common stress and what is traumatic stress. They don't have that baseline to base their assessment on. The second reason, caregivers unaware of the differences between adult and juvenile processing, which is what we've been talking about today. Let me give you an example of that. Somewhere in this picture is a young lady called Jessie. Do you want me to move back so you can take that picture? Jessie, on my first or second night at this retreat, we couldn't find her anywhere. I found her in a utility room, cowering in a corner in a fetal position, hands freezing and shaking and trying to breathe. And we talked about what was going on over the next few years. She lived in South America, and when she was 9, her 4-year-old sister had drowned, which of course was horrific, and the family was devastated by it. But within a couple of months, her parents started to notice the beautiful things that were happening in their ministry, people coming to Jesus because of witnessing the family's loss and faith in the middle of it. They started writing prayer letters that were very silver lining-y. They went on furlough or home ministry assignment, and they told the story of losing their daughter, but look at the wonderful thing that came out of it. They had found the silver linings with their mature faith, with each other for full understanding and support. And Jessie said that every time they would mention her sister's name, her hands would go cold, her chest would constrict, her heart would begin to race. And she is now 18 years old when I saw her this summer, and it was still happening. So these parents had not understood that what they were processing as adults was being felt, experienced, embodied as trauma in their daughter. Number three, MKs unwilling to report the trauma and the resulting suffering that comes from it. I asked a couple adult MKs to give me a brief insight into their mental health lives, and here's the first one. Her name is Marika, and I think she'll help to flesh out this point. She's an MK from China, I believe, but here's her story, and see what jumps out at you. I'd love to hear that afterwards.
Hi, my name's Marika, and I grew up in Macau, China from when I was 7 weeks old until I was 18. They worked in Hong Kong for a while, and then they moved to Macau to start a peace church with Mennonite Church Canada, which is the denomination we were sent out by. I think one of the most challenging things for me with my mental health has been anxiety around performance, and I don't mean on a stage or anything like that. As a missionary kid, our whole life in some ways is a stage. And so things like serving others, being a witness, and walking alongside others were things that I was told over and over as a kid that were things that we wanted to strive for. And it's still something, these are still things that I strive for, but it ultimately meant that I was terrified of admitting that when I was wrong, being in conflict with others, and of messing up because I didn't want to be a bad witness. I had heard stories from other people in the field and also other missionary friends, families who had to leave because their kids were struggling, and so I didn't want to be one of those kids. And so in some ways it created this really kind of difficult environment in which to just be a person, to make mistakes, learn from them, and grow. That's something that I just wish that I had had more, more space for. I also knew that Asian culture was quite shame-based, and so that was a struggle. And I was pretty aware as a kid that I was a white person, and so I was given a lot of privilege already, and so it was hard for me to ask for any help because it seemed ungrateful. I'm really grateful that my mom was also an MK, and so she talked a lot about her own depression when she transitioned back to Canada. I definitely experienced that as well. There would be days where I would just sleep 16 hours a day. I removed myself from a lot of social situations that were really challenging or that felt challenging at the time. I stopped doing a lot of the things that I enjoyed, which now I recognize are pretty tell signs of depression. And this was compounded by the fact that our denomination was going through structural changes. And I was learning a lot about colonialism and how missionaries impacted that. And that was devastating for me to realize that what I had thought was a really good thing that my parents did that was kind of idolized in the Christian community was actually a terrible enterprise in a lot of situations. Yeah, I still worry a lot about getting back to that depressive episode again. I have tried really hard not to get there, but I think that fear manifesting as anxiety, as kind of the combination of depression and anxiety, they dovetail each other. I've never been diagnosed with a mental illness, but I think part of that is not wanting to be needy or need help, and feeling like I'm just not being a very good witness if I'm struggling so much. A lot of people say that my brothers and I are well-adjusted. We socialize and in some ways we are. But I think for myself personally, this has meant performing my well-adjustment and compartmentalizing my struggles. I never want anything that I say or do to reflect poorly on my parents or the work that they did, or reflect poorly on Chinese culture, the people who raised me, or the Mennonite church in general. You may think, what does this have to do with mental illness? But as a missionary kid, if you've grown up with your whole life being about this Christian mission to serve and witness and love your neighbors, it's difficult then to say, I don't want to serve, I cannot witness. And those are all really valid things. But it's difficult to acknowledge that that's okay, even to yourself, much less to your parents or the sending organization or the church at large. Sometimes it's a very lonely place and a very hard place to then go out and ask for help. I think it's really important for missionary agencies to hold space for the really deep pain that missionary kids can often face when people have critiques about missions. And I think that just needs to be held and acknowledged and taken seriously. Thanks so much for trying to support MKs. Bless you in your work.
So that's Marika. And I really feel like I need to pause here and say being an MK is one of the most wonderful things that ever happens in anybody's life, in spite of that, in spite of what we're talking about. Again, a vast majority of them would never give it up for anything. And we need to be aware of this so that we can allow them to thrive and not have them tied down to the anvil of unresolved grief and trauma and mental illness. So that's why we're addressing what we are today. She has found Jesus. She is a firm believer, having a beautiful life right now and still working through, do I want to identify as somebody who has a depressive disorder or not? You heard her say that. What are some of the things that popped out at you as you were listening to her story? Yeah.
Yeah, I think a beautiful thing about being a missionary is you're with people all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a communal space and build relationships.
Yes.
But that's also meaning you're an official all the time. And so, yeah, you don't put that pressure on ourselves or our kids, but unknowingly.
It's there.
Yeah, so you can't not live that way.
Yes.
You know, so just trying to find that.
Yeah.
Balance, I think what she was saying beautifully is like, man, like, really making it okay to ask for help.
Yes.
You know, and maybe us here.
Yes.
Yeah. Being open.
Yeah.
In front of our face.
Yeah. 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 Yes. Normalizing it. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's really good.
Can I ask you,
yes.
Did you choose very, very articulate MK?
It is a pattern. Yes. 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 Yeah. I have sat with VMKs at this conference 2 days now, and I can tell you that they are amazing young people.
But I wonder if that's part of the expectation.
I think it is.
Push them to an adult structure of communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I don't see it as pushing them towards that. I think that they hang out with adults a lot more. So they're just more used to being with articulate people, and they learn the articulate way of expressing themselves from talking with adults. You don't know a whole lot of American teenagers who spend a lot of time in conversation with adults, in meaningful conversation with adults, right? So I think it's actually a good thing.
Maybe the dual language.
Yes. Yes. That could, yeah, it's surprising, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, the buyer trilingual thing does impact them. And I'm telling you, these young people, your young people that I've been with, even the youngest ones would open their mouths and just blow me away the last 2 days with not only the way they express themselves, but what they grasp at their age is just astounding, and the nuanced way that they talk about things. So, yes, there's a quality there that needs to be recognized, yeah. Anything else that jumped out at you? Yes, ma'am. Right. Right. Wow. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And then she referred to us that bouncing him to different languages helped him and did not hurt him.
Yep.
Yep. That he would have been way worse had he not been encouraged to speak other languages.
Yes.
I think it can be really discouraging to look at this stuff.
Yes.
But then our kids are also
yeah.
positive.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. 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 And they've experienced things that the rest of the world has never experienced, and they've been given opportunities that other kids have not been given. If we put the bundle of the wonderful that comes from being an MK next to the bundle of the hard stuff, I mean, it would be this kind of a thing. But it's to prevent that one out of five MKs from going unseen and untreated that we do focus on this. But we need to, as families, be sitting around and talking about the amazing stuff that happens as well so that they can validate that. I told them this morning that the hard stuff is going to jump up and wave its arms in front of your face and make itself known to you. And the good stuff, you're going to have to go looking for it because it doesn't jump up and wave its arms. So to exercise gratitude in an intentional way so that they're equally aware of the amazing and able to put words to the less amazing, to the harder stuff as well. Thank you for validating that. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Yeah. 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 Oh my goodness. Yes. Well, I'm not a clinician, but I will tell you this. Shyness is a personality trait. It's a personality trait. I am a raging introvert. Ask my mom if I could talk to anybody when I was little. It's a personality trait. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't have a PhD, but I can pretty confidently say that shyness is, and it's to be celebrated as well and validated as well, because the shy people are going to have all these qualities that we don't see necessarily on the surface, but they're the creatives, they're the emotives, the connective tissue. A lot of times without words are the shy people. Yeah, yeah. Thank you for asking that question. Yes. Yeah.
Would sometimes a teacher who may not necessarily know that child very well kind of think that because they're shy and introverted that they could be like borderline on the autism spectrum?
Yeah. Yeah. It can happen. I mean, that's where really professionals are the resources that we need.
But sometimes if a child is shy.
Yeah. It can be. It can be a symptom.
A teacher could
think that. Yeah. I feel bad for shy people because I am one. I know it doesn't show when I'm standing on a stage talking to people. But it's so often misunderstood and kind of mislabeled. So each shy person needs to be known to figure out where it's from.
I was asking that because sometimes maybe they may not feel like they fit.
Yes. Yes.
At school.
Yes.
They distance themselves from the other kids who they don't feel like they have anything.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that. There's kind of the self-isolation. There's also risk avoidance that would make them not want to connect with people at the risk of being rejected. And there's also what we talked about yesterday a little bit, is that they'll stand at the back of the room for sometimes weeks or months and scan an environment before they step into it because they're so culturally aware that they don't want to just jump in and do something wrong. So all of those look like shyness, but they're not necessarily shyness. So each case, I think, needs to be each person, not case, needs to be explored if they're showing signs of that. Yeah. Okay. So these are some of the reasons that they don't report. I'll just quickly put them up there, and you can snap that picture. Not wanting to burden their parents. They're so busy. They're so stressed. Not wanting to appear weak or needy. I'm an MK. I should be resilient. Not wanting to be disloyal. God called my family. Who am I to complain about the calling? Not wanting to demonstrate insufficient faith that should go away if I just prayed harder or more. Fear that there will be no help. This is just who I am and nobody can really understand me, so I'm just kind of stuck. And fear that putting it into words will actually make it worse. Of course, we know that's not the case. Number four, MKs and caregivers who are uninformed about the process of healing. There is miraculous healing. I know that to be true. In most cases, there will be a process of healing that has to happen. Because trauma, as we've said, damages the brain. It's hard to just snap out of it. It's going to take a retraining of the brain. And a lot of times, that's going to take all of the love and support of the family, all of the prayer, all of the learning who Jesus is and how close he is to them, and sometimes some professional help as well. And there are all kinds of new modalities that are available to people who have been through trauma that works for PTSD people who have come off the war-torn parts of this world that can now be applied to people who have maybe small T trauma and not the big T trauma as well. I will add, because a lot of people talk about small T versus big T trauma, an accumulation of small T traumas that does end up being processed as a big T trauma. So for MKs, that can be true as well. So what are the five essential gifts that we can give our suffering MKs? I'm going to go through these fast because I really want to touch quickly on mental illness as well before we end today. The first is revelation, creating opportunities and safe environments in which the suffering can talk about what they're going through. The chance to reveal what is really going on with them, as well as the great, fun, enjoyable stuff that's also going on in their lives. The second one is confirmation, letting the hurting know that what they're describing is awful, and of course you're in pain, and I get it, and thank you for telling me. Not going, well, I know, but these other people have it worse. Or, thanks for telling me, but it's not really that big of a deal. We're doing fine. Letting them know, confirming. when I was at my worst in my mid-20s, I saw a counselor one night, and the words that changed my life were, "Of course you're broken." I went to him, I told him everything that had happened in the course of my life. I just vomited it because he wasn't with my mission and I'd probably never see him again, so it was safe. And when I was finished telling him all of my stuff, he said, "Of course you're broken." And nobody had ever given me permission to be broken. They had always said, pray your way through it, think your way through it, you know, whatever. So permission to be broken is important. The third is affirmation. Strongly stating that reporting what happened to them is neither weakness nor lack of faith, but that it's brave and it's courageous and it's standing up for yourself and it's seeking help. This is all good. Facilitation, helping them to find the help they need. There are so many different forms of help available to us today. There is the kind of the family lay help, helping them in the unit of the family. There's getting outside help. There's biblical counseling. There's medical help. There's clinical help. Pursuing the help that they need until you found what is actually helping, often in conjunction with the other forms of help, too. Kind of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. Yes?
What's the difference between confirmation and affirmation?
Confirmation is saying, yes, what you're reporting is truly awful. Affirmation means that you reported it is great. You did a great job reporting that. Yeah. And finally, devotion. Sticking with them. Coming through trauma might take weeks or months. It might take years. And they need to know that you're along for the long haul. And helping them to see those small incremental steps toward healing. Hey, did you see that we did that yesterday and you couldn't do that last year? Look at you making these small steps, because they're not going to see the small steps. But we do. We the outsiders. Three books that I would recommend. The Bible on all things trauma is The Body Keeps the Score. It's a heavy read. It's a huge book. But it has all the information you will ever need on trauma. The second one, Suffering and the Heart of God by Diane Langberg. She is a Christian therapist who is the foremost voice, I think, in that realm on trauma. She has a podcast. She has multiple books, but this is a good starting point. And then Andy Kolber, I mentioned, I quoted her earlier. She is also a Christian counselor, and she has such gentleness in her approach to people who are suffering. And again, with young people, her podcast might be a really great place to start. So in just our few remaining minutes, let me look at mental health. Lauren Wells is the director of TCK Training, which I've mentioned before, and this is some of the information that she compiled. TCKs are 3 times more likely to feel trapped, which is coded language for a form of anxiety, and the 3 times more likely to feel depressed than the average monocultural peer. And given everything that we've talked about today, I think we can all agree that there's good reason for that and that there are good solutions for that as well.
Hi again, it's Dr. Jen, and I've noticed something with my patients. They often describe to me some classic symptoms of an anxiety disorder: constant worry, trouble sleeping, tense muscles, and struggle with concentrating. Severe anxiety isn't a moral or personal failing. It's a health problem, just like strep throat or diabetes. It needs to be treated with the same kind of seriousness. Before we can talk about anxiety disorders, let's talk about anxiety itself. Anxiety is the very real and normal emotion we feel in a stressful situation. It's related to fear, but while fear is a response to an immediate threat that quickly subsides, anxiety is a response to more uncertain threats that tends to last much longer. It's all part of the threat detection system, which all animals have to some degree to help protect us from predators. Anxiety starts in the brain's amygdala, a pair of almond-sized nerve bundles that alert other areas of the brain to be ready for defensive action. Next, the hypothalamus relays the signal, setting off what we call the stress response in our body. Our muscles tense, our breathing and heart rate increase, and our blood pressure rises. Areas in the brainstem kick in and put you in a state of high alertness. This is the fight or flight response. There are ways the fight or flight response is kept somewhat in check, with an area of higher level thinking called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. It works like this. If a person sees something they think is dangerous, like a tiger, that sends a signal to the amygdala saying it's time to run. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex can say to the amygdala, hey, look, the tiger's in a cage. You know what a cage is. They can't escape from a cage. It's okay to calm down. It's a feedback loop that can help keep the response in check. The hippocampus is also involved. It provides context, saying things like, hey, we've seen tigers in cages before. We're in a zoo. You are extra safe. With anxiety, these threat detection systems and mechanisms that reduce or inhibit them are functioning incorrectly and cause us to worry about the future and our safety in it. But for many people, it goes into overdrive. They experience persistent, pervasive anxiety that disrupts work, school, and relationships and leads them to avoid situations that may trigger symptoms. Anxiety disorders are not at all uncommon. Studies have shown that people with anxiety disorders don't just have a different way of reacting to stress. There may be actual differences in how their brain is working. One model describes possible mix-ups in the connections between the amygdala and other parts of the brain. The pathways that signal anxiety become stronger, and the more anxiety you have, the stronger the pathways become, and it becomes a vicious cycle. The good news is that there's treatment for anxiety and that you don't have to suffer.
So I wanted to show that to you. I showed you the depression one earlier, and depression and anxiety are the two most common things that I'm seeing in MKs these days. And I just wanted you to understand that it isn't just, again, situational nervousness or fear, that it's something that gets kind of embedded in us. And until 5 years ago, I would have thought that it was just kind of long-term fear. And now I know from personal experience that it is so debilitating and frightening. And anxiety feeds anxiety. I start to be anxious about getting anxious. And there's just no way out of that cycle, except that there is, but it feels like there is no way out of that cycle when we're in the middle of it. So that was your primer on anxiety. And again, we think that it'll turn up as fear. It can turn up as sleeplessness, as irritability, as inability to focus, as withdrawing from people or leaving situations that are overwhelming. When it first struck me, I would be in the middle of a dinner and I would have to go home to bed and lie down and have no noise for 2 hours until it would finally begin to ease, until I got diagnosed for what it was and got the help I needed. So anxiety among MKs is prevalent enough that I wanted you to know about those. So mental health disorders come from trauma a lot of times, and for some of us, we're just wired in that way. We are more depressive in our outlook. When I was growing up, my mom had this group of adults who wrote poetry and would sit around and we'd read poetry to each other, and I was invited to join when I was 11 or 12, something like that. And I sat with them for the first time on our puffy cushions and candlelight and all that stuff, and they read these beautiful poems about God and nature and love, and I wrote a poem about a baby seal being bludgeoned to death. So some of us are just a little internally wired to see the French side of things, and I blame my mom for that. I don't really, but you gotta blame somebody. So there is a propensity in some children to be affected more strongly than others, and that's okay. That's part of the beauty of how they were created, and we can help them to manage that if we're aware of what they're seeing that we might not be seeing. So what can we do to lessen the impact of grief and trauma and mental health on the MKs that we love? And again, the MKs I have seen here are head and shoulders above their peers in their ability to process and understand and articulate things and be friends to each other. I love the way they care for each other, as some of them were showing a little bit of emotion yesterday and today, the way they circled each other and just really cared well. Head and shoulders ahead of their peers. So how can we help them to manage this stressful and pressure-filled life that is also the greatest gift they could possibly be given? Let me give you a few suggestions, and then I'll show you Megan's story, and then we can open it for questions, and then we'll be done. Create a family culture of open communication. We've said this before. It's so important from a young age to allow parents and children to speak openly. One of the tools that MTI in Colorado Springs developed is the Paradux. Have you heard of those? Two little rubber duckies, a paradox to express a paradox. And to make it part of the family culture, to pass this paradox, one is decorated happy and one is decorated in darker colors, to pass it around the table, and every member of the family says, this is my yay duck and this is my yuck duck for the day. And we're normalizing talking about the yays and the yucks and balancing out the experiences of each family member. If we can do that from a young age, it will begin to create this family culture. Pay attention to signs that not all is well. And I've heard MK say, my parents are so busy, they don't even see what's going on with me. And I don't want to interrupt them because they're doing God's work. So as adults, to take it upon ourselves to pay attention. I can send this to you later. It's going to be too small for these screens. Maybe not. But here are just some of the warning signs that all is not well with children. And we need to really remind ourselves of what those warning signs are, go back to it every so often, make sure we're not seeing any of that in the children. Because again, they might be loving a lot of parts of life. And so we need to be aware that there are other parts of their lives that aren't as obvious. Waiting for all the cameras. Destigmatize seeking help. Somebody said this earlier. Mom and dad are going to go see the pastor because we need prayer. Mom and dad are going to see a counselor because we're at each other's throats a lot these days and we don't want to do that. This horrible thing that just happened, it's overwhelming me, so I'm going to go see a counselor to help me talk through it. So part of destigmatizing is showing them that adults who know Jesus and who are active in ministry also need the help that we're encouraging our young people to get. Engage in family and individual debriefs. There are a lot of organizations that offer this nowadays. If your children are particularly aware of the eyes on them, maybe find an organization other than the one that you're serving with to do a debrief. They might feel safer around people that they don't already know. If possible, have them regularly. And if there is a major life event from the perspective of your children that you might not process as such, but that they would process as such, drop everything and get the debrief then. A lot of times I see missionaries waiting until their next home assignment. In 2 years, we'll do a debrief. If there's something major that happened, raise the funds, whatever it takes, to get them the help more quickly so it doesn't quite anchor so deeply in them. 5, don't assume that the children have the ability or faith to withstand and process what you can. I'll remind you of the story of Jessie and her little sister who died and how her parents assumed that, of course, she would be able to process it as rationally as we do. Here's a quote. If children and teens have been exposed to something adults find troubling, scary, or destabilizing, their young hearts and minds will feel the same events as terrifying, horrifying, and traumatizing. Do you hear the difference in those two sets of words? We need to be aware of that. 6 of 7, speak about God as someone who understands grief. Not the dictator, not the job we do, not the image we protect, not the order giver we follow, but someone who is acquainted with grief and who loves them and who is not in the least bothered that they might be depressed or have anxiety or be angry at him or want to lash out. He is not at all bothered with that. He is that coach, right? In fact, I think I have it right there. Remind them that this is who God is, because so many times we inadvertently say the opposite. I love that so much. And then finally, be willing to rescue him or her from a context that is toxic and damaging. This is controversial. I wrote an article about this a while back that got some significant pushback, but I do believe that there are times when the wellness of one member of the family is important enough for the rest of the family to leave a place where they are thriving. I had a woman call me from a remote location. They had been there for 2 years trying to plant a church. They had 3 children. The church was just about to open its doors within 2 or 3 weeks from when she called me. And their son was dying on the branch. They had tried everything. They had tried homeschooling and public schooling. They had tried soccer teams, and they had tried Skyping with his friends back home. They had tried everything, and at age 12, he was starting to talk about harming himself. And she said, is it wrong for me to think that maybe we need to go to a place where he can get better help? And I said, no, I don't think that's wrong. So this is the article if you want to look it up. I believe that God cares for that little kid who is the one in the family who isn't doing well, and that sometimes we have to circle the wagons around the weakest or the most suffering, I don't want to say weakest, in order to help them towards wellness, and then we can reassess how to move forward. So one last story from an MK. Her name is Megan. And she's a beautiful soul as well, but I want you to see on her face how much she loves life. She's newly married. She loves having been an MK in Germany where she grew up with her brother and her family, and she has some mental illness diagnoses, and she is working her way towards wellness. So here's Megan.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an adult third culture kid. I'm a missionary kid from Poland and Germany, and I have some mental health diagnoses, and I wanted to share today with you how being an MK has impacted my mental health. I currently have the diagnoses of depression and anxiety, panic disorder, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as an eating disorder. And those things have been greatly impacted by my upbringing as a missionary kid. And that's not to say that being an MK is all bad. It is, these are titles that I carry with pride, and they have shaped my worldview for the better. And yet at the same time, there are a lot of things about being a missionary kid that, especially I think when I was a kid and a teenager, weren't really, people weren't aware of how these little experiences, or they seem little, might impact us. And some of those things include saying goodbye to people frequently, moving all the time, transitioning between and in and out of cultures, whether that's you're going for home assignment, then going back to your local country, moving between countries, even going to conferences. I think we don't realize how much our MKs go through and how many goodbyes they say and how many people they meet. And also just especially going on home assignment, you're the missionary kid, you're the pastor's kid, and having to present yourself in a way that makes your parents proud and also doesn't affect their support raising. And so it's a lot of pressure for a kid. It's a lot of pressure for a teenager. And it also creates a sense of instability. And for me in particular, it really impacted how I am able to engage in friendships. I've really struggled with boundaries. I've really struggled with trusting others. And I've really struggled with just kind of feeling like when people get to know me, they're going to leave, because that's kind of been my norm. At the same time, there's a sense of where do I belong? I, in Germany, am the American, and in the US, I'm the German. And yet I don't have citizenship of Germany, but that's the place that I would call home. So there's a constant longing for a place, and then going back to that place and it being different. And traditions, holidays have typically been pretty difficult because you don't realize how much you miss these smells, these tastes, the atmosphere until you're gone. And people don't understand that. And so there's a large part too, even people in my life now, my husband, for example, who don't understand my life and will never, because they didn't experience the same thing. So it can feel really isolating. It feel really lonely. It's also my those things have really impacted my body as well. So it's impacted my mental health, but I truly believe that our mental health and our body are connected. And so I've experienced some pretty significant physical illnesses as a result of some of these traumas, a lot of these traumas that I experienced. And that's really what it is there, whether they're big T traumas or little T traumas, it's traumas. So I have had to really look at how can I heal from this. And I really struggled with being really angry, especially with my parents. I really struggled with being angry at God. And yet my counselor, who's a former missionary and loves working with third culture kids, which is a huge blessing to me, started working on a book with me called Unstacking Your Grief Tower. And it has brought immense healing to my life by being able to acknowledge that I am grieving. I'm grieving my childhood and the lack of home, the lack of family, the constant goodbyes. I'm grieving not having consistent friendships. I'm grieving moving, I'm grieving now being in the U.S. and missing my home and not knowing how to create a new home. But in acknowledging that and having somebody who has validated those experiences and has validated that what I've experienced is trauma and pointed out to me that I'm not actually crazy when I respond to things in a certain way, it has really solidified that I am really created by a God who loves me dearly and did not desire this for me, but that I can now in turn help other MKs and other TCKs really with their own stories and their mental health. So healing is possible and it's beautiful. A huge part of that, I think, is really just validating and supporting people and being aware of what we go through as missionary kids and third culture kids.
So you see her joy in being at MK. She loves being an MK. And she has reconciled with her parents. There was some little clashing going on there for a while. But she loves being an MK. And she is now working through the downside of being an MK so that she can fully live on the side that loves being an MK. And I wanted to end with her because I think there's such hope in her testimony. And she honestly, as I was asking her to record this, I asked her, what are your plans for the future? And she said, well, my husband and I want to become missionaries. So she is going to be raising her own MKs. So for any of you who might still be harboring the wrong concept that raising MKs is doing them a disfavor, I want you to know that even people like her who are now starting to get things together are saying, I want my kids to have the great experiences that I had as well. I'm just going to be a little bit more intentional in looking at those things that can be a little bit more difficult. A word from my publisher, when I'm not doing stuff like this, I'm writing novels that are published by Thomas Nelson and Tyndale. But I wanted to point out, especially the one in the bottom right of Stillness and Storm, is if anybody in your life struggles to understand some of the hardships of being a missionary as opposed to just the joys and what we write in our prayer letters, that is a book that looks at the underbelly of the missionary experience in a family that did it all wrong. So I know it's not like any of you sitting in this room, but it's a family that got their priorities wrong and made some of the choices for all the wrong reasons. So that's the one that I wanted to point out to you. We are, I think, right on the dot at 3 p.m. If there any question or comment that you make that would be valuable for the whole group, now is the time to do it. Otherwise, you can just talk to me afterwards if you have anything else to ask about. Any? Yes? Yeah. It has not been recorded, but all of this is on my website. There's an article about trauma. There's an article about mental illness, grief. It's all on the website, just in smaller pieces. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Next time? Next time. Thank you so much, everybody. I know it was like drinking from a very dark, what do you call those fire hoses? But now we know, right? So now we can celebrate the fabulous and help them to recognize the challenges as well. Thank you so much.